Made in the city. For the city.
We are Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour with Ruth Reyes, Alan Alder and me, Matt Bittman.
We have a nice mixture of old favourites and new faces today. We find out about Jack of Jack Gelato's fame and his extraordinary restaurant career. And how many sandwich bar owners were trained by Raymond Blanc? Well, Cambridge certainly has one, as we discover when we visit the Urban Shed in King Street.
We get an early look at what's coming up in this year's Eat Cambridge Food Festival from Caroline Biggs. We investigate cumin, our spice of the month, with Nazima from Fronglay Kitchen. And have you thought about the fun you could have organising tastings with friends and family? Gigi Perry has a few tips for you.
And on the drinks front, we've heard lots about the advances in food preparation through the use of molecular gastronomy. But can those ideas be extended to what we drink? Aoife Maxwell has been experimenting. And in addition, Tom Lewis will be here to tell us about the wines from the Jura region of France.
And as usual, at the end of the programme, we'll give you an update of forthcoming supper clubs and pop-up restaurants, as well as other food and drink news.
OK, so let's begin with Spice of the Month. Now, earlier in the week, Alan went to see Nazima of Fronglay Kitchen to find out about cumin and what you can do with it.
Nazima, this is a plate full of very nice looking food, and I know that the spice of the month this month is cumin. So
yes.
Can you tell me what's here?
Yeah, sure. So what we've done is here we've got some ingredients within this plate that go well with cumin. First of all, the priming thing is lamb. We have got slow braised lamb shank. First of all, we cut off the fat and the cartilage, and
yeah.
Then we cooked it in a sous vide water bath for 36 hours, but we spiced it with cumin and a little bit of cinnamon and some cayenne pepper.
Right. And with the cumin powder,
just
presumably,
powder,
since
as
I can't
dry
see
rub.
Any seeds.
Yeah,
right.
So it's a dry rub, which actually has worked really well because it seems to have given it a bit of colour, because one of the problems about cooking in the water bath is you don't get the browning, so you'd normally have to finish it off. As you can see, it's very, very tender. And it's got a lovely flavour, hasn't it? But what's lovely about the slow cooking is that it melts the fat out and it still tastes tender. And if you do have a sous vide, it's very important with lamb shanks, particularly to cut off that fat, because otherwise it really is horrible, because it doesn't brown, it doesn't burn and get crispy.
What about the safety aspects of it, the killing any bacteria that might be on the meat? What do you do? Because a temperature of, 76 isn't
exactly
going to do
that. Well, no, it will. So there is a certain critical temperature and you have to be well above 60 degrees Celsius. And because there is a risk, you're slow cooking in a vacuumed environment, so potentially there's anaerobic bacteria that can proliferate. So cooking meat from the fridge, so it has to be fridge cold when it goes in, it has to be cooled down in ice water bath, the bags when they come out, to really make sure that you're not having the meat lingering at a temperature in between fridge cold and cooking temperature. So cooking at 72 nothing will kill it, obviously, unless you boil it, but that will not allow the bacteria to grow, the natural bacteria on the meat.
Right, so there's no
and
danger.
So it's safe, yeah.
Yeah.
But that is something one needs to be aware of. And then with that, we've got a potato mifo, which is just slices of potato seasoned with salt and pepper, and some asparagus that we've just cooked simply with salt and pepper. And then this is a cauliflower and cumin puree. So cauliflower goes very nicely, the sweetness of the cauliflower contrasting well with the bitterness of and woodiness of the cumin. So that was, again, cooked for about 20 minutes. It's a strong flavour, so, you know, it's probably just a little accent that we'd have in the dish.
It's nice.
Classically, you know, cumin will go well with a lot of vegetables.
One of the potential problems, I think, with cumin is it can make everything taste the same if you use it, you know, without caution, I suppose.
Yes.
But here it doesn't. The cauliflower does taste very different. The spicing in the cauliflower tastes very different to the meat, and that's just a matter of...
Well, I think also because we've added some other spices lamb. So I think that's one of the things about cumin is it is one of the stronger spices. It's very evident and fragrant, and it has a lovely flavour and great with slow cooking and roasting. by mixing it with other spices, as with Moroccan and Middle Eastern cuisine in Ras El Hanout spice mix, and also with Indian spices such as with garam masala, it can make a really nice part of a complex, more complex layered spice.
But there are different, I suppose, varieties of cumin, aren't there? Because when I was in Morocco, the cumin there was far more pungent, I suppose, than the cumin I've been used to. And I don't know whether it's just fresher or is it just a different...
It must be a different variety that has more fragrance, but that's true. And I know that a lot of Moroccan cookbooks would advise using Moroccan cumin, although I haven't seen it widely available.
I haven't either. So what else does cumin go well with then?
Cumin, so if you were looking at Moroccan food, for example, apricots, that's one of the things that seems to apparently go well with. In terms of salad vegetables, so in Indian food, of course, a lot of people have tried raita, and raita is a balance of yogurt, cucumber and cumin. The cumin, again, the woodiness of the cumin and the sort of slightly bitterness of the cucumber going really nicely with the cooling effect of the yogurt and slight sweetness of it. So that's a classic side dish. But also in salads, the Indians will put it on to dress the salad, so you'll mix it in with some cumin and some lemon juice with cucumbers and with carrots, grated carrots. And also goes nicely with tomato, I would think.
And
so.
In its powdered form or in its seed?
Powdered form. Now, the seed is quite hard and it has a woody flavour. You can use it in baking, for example. You could make cumin crackers, cumin biscuits, and I know Hugh Fernley Whitting still has a recipe for cumin cookies, sweet cookies. But in general, you know, the best way to get the best out of it is to get the whole seeds, roast them slightly, and then to powder it and use it as you fresh.
So rather than buying the powdered form, because that will lose its...
Obviously, that's convenient, even we use the powdered form more often than not, but...
But when you talk about cumin with apricots, is that in savoury dishes?
I think so, yes, exactly.
Meat tagines, for example.
Yes, I did have a look to see if I could find any desserts, and I think it is quite a savoury spice. So apart from the cumin cookies, I haven't seen anything else, and I can't imagine it. So, although possibly paired with cinnamon or a touch of cumin, such as you might use allspice in cakes and cookies, you know, it might actually be an interesting thing, so it might be something to try.
Yeah. I wonder about it in ice cream, actually.
Yes,
but,
yes, we'll have to ask Jack's gelato, I guess.
Yes, we will.
And thanks to Nazima for that, and we'll be having news about the next Franglais Kitchen Supper Club at the end of the programme. Now, ever anxious to find out about interesting combinations, Alan then did talk with Jack from Jack's Gelato, and he found out about the possibility of cumin gelato. Will we see it on sale in Nord in Sussex Street? Also, Alan found out about some of Jack's previous culinary experience. Now, this includes working at Chez Panisse in the noughties, and that's a restaurant in Berkeley, California. And during those years, it was judged to be the number one restaurant in America, 12th best in the world, and highly influential well beyond the US. But the conversation began closer to home, with Alan asking which of his gelato flavours were currently the most popular.
Over the counter at Nord, people are fairly conservative, so they you know, they like to see, I think, slightly more adventurous flavours, and they'll maybe have a sample taste. But certainly the most popular flavours will be things such as stracciatella, chocolate sorbet, you know, very easy and accessible flavours, though salted licorice also has a strong niche following, and extra virgin olive oil, that's another popular one. Yeah, and then for home delivery, people are a bit more adventurous. Popular flavours would be extra virgin olive oil, as we mentioned, PX sherry and raisin, single malt whiskey, Dilton, pear and white miso sorbet, Carnaroli rice and cinnamon.
Well, I must say the Stilton one is amazing because it just seems so right. And yet it doesn't sound so right. But it really brings out the best of Stilton and the best of ice cream, really.
It's one I'm very pleased with. So I'm very conscientious about not doing gimmicky flavours. It's not like I'm just doing things to be different or to attract attention. You know, they'll all go through a development process and they'll have come from certain inspiration. So it's things such as the Stilton and the extra virgin olive oil, I think they work marvellously in ice cream. They're certainly not just gimmicks.
I was talking to Nazima from Franglais Kitchen the other day. We were talking about cumin, and you don't see cumin in desserts very often, and we wondered whether a cumin gelato would work. She suggested I ask you.
It's really funny that you should ask that. As Deepa contacted me, who was running a vegetarian Indian Gujarati supper club, And she informed me, which I didn't know, that cumin and mango is a popular combination. She asked me if I would do a cumin and mango ice cream. So I then suggested that I do an Alfonso mango sorbet and a cumin ice cream and then serve the two together. Then I did a couple of prototypes for her, and I was a bit apprehensive about the idea. It was one that I, you know, thought I'm not sure it would work. But it was lovely. I did a couple of ones. So I did one where I did a cumin caramel. So I did a sugar caramel and then I put the cumin seeds in. So it looked just like a huge sesame snap, but with cumin seeds instead. And then smashed that up and then put that through the ice cream, which gave it a nice textural quality and really brought out the flavour of the cumin. And then I just did a straight cumin infused ice cream. Yeah, they were good.
Right, so it does work then.
Yeah, it does. But there was a certain level of astringency, which maybe wouldn't be to everyone's taste. I mean, I don't think it's going to overtake vanilla overnight, but there's a place for it in the cabinet.
So might it be amongst your plans for summer?
I think it will make an outing, yeah. I mean, it's tough and there's so many flavours, so everything's kind of on rotation and
yeah. Well, I enjoyed some of your summer flavors last year. In particular, the fig leaf, which I found amazing. Might you be doing that again?
Yes, fig leaf will be coming back as a flavor that I'm fond of. A, since I like the taste of it. B, because I like the fact that I can just go and pick fig leaves from the garden. So you can't really get more local than that.
And where can people buy your ice cream from? Obviously, Nord is one place. Are there any other outlets?
I mean, many conversations with different people about them stocking my ice cream. So, yes, watch this space on that one. But currently, you know, Nord is my main outlet and it's probably the place that will always have the largest number of flavours. So they always have at least 10 flavours. I have my tricycles again, which I'm... we'll hopefully have out this summer. So there's, you know, which I announce on Twitter. The Junction, again, they sell little prepackaged pots during their theatre performances. But yeah, no, watch this space.
Right, so it's business is building up.
Business is building, yes. People are coming to me and asking how they can stock it. And we're, you know, I'm looking at various feasibility options at the moment. So I'm working with another small food producer in Norfolk and she wants to take my ice cream to different events in Norfolk, so we're working out transport logistics for that. Yes, yeah, there's lots of things happening.
But your expertise isn't limited to ice cream, is it? Because I think at one point you co-owned Cotto.
Yes, yeah, my career's taken me to lots of different places. I ran and co-owned Cotto for the first 3 years.
So when would that have been? What sort of time was that?
2005 to 2008. And then we sold it to Hans and Ruth. And I went to cook at Chez Panisse in California. And then I moved to France and cooked in France for a couple of years before moving back to Cambridge to start Jack's Gelato in 2011.
Before Cotto, was there anything before Cotto?
Before Cotto, I did my apprenticeship at the Pink Geranium, which was in Melbourne. I worked there for 3 years from apprentice commis up to senior sous chef. Prior to that, I worked in different kitchens in Canada, which is where I started cooking originally on a whim when I was travelling. That's when it all started, really.
And how do you feel now about having left the restaurant scene? Because life in restaurants must be extraordinarily intense and possibly a bit trying at the time, but is it not something that sometime after you've left it behind, you miss it? Are you hankering after returning?
I am. It is something that is often on my mind. Restaurant work is that kind of curious combination of exhaustion and exhilaration. And I do miss the buzz sometimes, which is why I do these pop-up events with Leo from Steak and Honour. And, you know, I cooked with Rosie on a part-time basis for a while at Fitzbillies when they first did their reopening. But yeah, it is something, when my daughter's in school, it's something I'll be looking to return to.
Well, that should be interesting. We look forward to receiving a tweet about that.
God, Jack's got an impressive background.
Yeah, it explains a lot, doesn't it? Yeah. I must say, the prospect of Jack perhaps even opening up his own place in the future is pretty exciting. Cotto is for sale now, of course, but as he explained, it's probably a bit too early for him at the moment.
Oh, you're right, though. Just how awesome would it be?
Totally awesome. Yes, it would be, but there are other things to enjoy before that happens. For example, in May, there will be the second Cambridge Food and Drink Festival, Eat Cambridge. Last year's was enormously successful with the events completely packed out. This year there are even more events and bigger venues, as Alan found out when he spoke with one of the festival organisers, Caroline Biggs.
Well, it's going to be similar to last year's event, but bigger. We've got the Corn Exchange this year for the main event, and the whole festival is running from the 10th till the 24th of May.
And have you got things like street food again?
Yeah, we've got street food and pop-ups. And lots of exciting events.
Okay, well, let's just talk about street food for a moment, because that's something that's sort of really flourishing in Cambridge. And last year, it was in Hope Yard, wasn't it, the street food event?
Yes,
and although the weather was pretty unpleasant...
It wasn't kind.
A lot of people were there.
It was absolutely rammed.
And there was a good atmosphere as well.
Yeah, it was really exciting. And it was a great place to have a street food festival, actually. Very grungy and Mill Roady. It was just really beautiful.
Yeah, but... I guess you're going to need somewhere bigger for that this year, really.
Well, of course, there are more people doing street food now, so we need a much bigger venue. We've got an exciting venue in the pipeline, much bigger.
Something else that's grown enormously since last year is pop-ups and supper clubs.
Yeah, there's a real trend for it. It's just amazing. I mean, all over the country, not just in Cambridge. I think it's a very convivial way of dining, actually, and meeting new people. It's like actually going to a dinner party, but you don't know anybody. And the food is usually pretty good.
Yeah, and everybody's there for the food. So you've got something in common
Absolutely.
With everybody.
Yes.
And the food's often stuff that you might not come across normally as well, I think.
Yes. There's very ethnic foods and fusion foods.
And so there's a good number of pop-ups this year, are there?
Yes, there are several. Yeah, in different guises.
In what way, in different
guises? Well, there's some sort of pop-up tea parties as opposed to supper clubs.
Right, so this sounds like cakes.
Well, not just cakes, other things. You'll all know soon.
So there's quite a few pop-ups. And are there many sort of new people who you haven't had in the previous one?
Well, for the main event on the 17th at the Corn Exchange, we've got loads of new people, actually. It's been interesting how we've lost a few people, like Pavitt's Pies, you know about, and Seasonability and the Biscuit Jar. They're people who have had to stop doing what they're doing. But there are new people coming along all the time, and we've got some very exciting people coming.
Last year it was in the Guildhall, wasn't it? And you had about 30 stalls.
Yeah, about 32, I think it was.
And again, that got really full, didn't it?
Oh, it was absolutely packed, yeah.
So this year in the Corn Exchange, and have you got more stands there?
Yeah, much bigger venue. So we've got 50 stalls. Right. Also, which is really exciting, and it's also some feedback we had from last year, is people wanted somewhere they could sit and eat. So we're actually going to use the mezzanine floor in the Corn Exchange as a cafe. So people can either buy food from the stallholders, or there'll be someone there selling great coffee and paninis and things. So there'll be somewhere people can sit and just, you know, soak up the atmosphere.
Last year at the main event at the Guildhall, there were talks going on as well. Are you doing that at the Corn Exchange?
We are. Last year, the talks were actually a bit of an add-on. We didn't really think through very clearly, to be honest. And we were amazed how many people actually specifically came for the talks. So this year, having a much larger venue, we've actually now got a room dedicated for the talks. So we're going to have a series of talks. And again, Tim Hayward's going to help chair those and to be sort of master of ceremonies. And so again, they'll be listed in the brochure when it's out.
What sort of talks did you have last year?
We had talks about chocolate, wine tasting, cocktails, positively good for you olive oil, demos on making sourdough from Tina at the cookery school. Alan Brigham came to talk about how important it is to keep shopping locally and independently.
Right, so a wide range.
Yeah, and we've got some similar talks again this year.
So again, covering a wide range of foodie matters.
Yes. And the talks are all going to be free. It's going to be first come, first served. But the room will seat about 50 people.
So there's no booking for them?
There's no booking for those,
right.
No.
Right, well, I think they'll be eagerly sought after
I
too.
Think so.
And again, last year there was a debate, which I really enjoyed, actually. And you've got one again this year?
Oh, we're so excited about our debate. Mainly the venue, because we've got the Union Chamber. So it's really exciting for us. Cambridge Union.
The debating chamber.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great venue.
Yeah, it is.
And you can get a lot of people in there as
You can, yes. I'm actually not sure how many, but it must be a couple of hundred.
Oh, I think it is a couple of hundred. And what's the debate going to be about?
The title is, This House Believes That We Can Make Cambridge the Next Foodie Destination. And we've got a really interesting panel of people to debate that.
Who's there then?
Well, Tim Hayward is going to chair the debate.
Good.
And then we've got Roger Taylor from Cambridge University, from the development team. Mark Poynton, who everyone will know, from Alimentum.
Alimentum, yeah.
Gigi Perry.
From Flavour on Cambridge,
yes.
105. Yeah,
and who writes for Varsity magazine.
Yeah.
And we've got Mr. Neil B., who I'm sure lots of people will know, from the Cambridge Fruit Company. And also another we're just trying to secure at the moment. So it looks to be a really good debate, lots to talk about.
Last year it was an hour, I seem to remember. Is it the same sort of
time? Yeah,
it's
about an hour and a half, because we've got plenty of time for questions. I think with such a distinguished panel, people are going to want to ask questions. I think debate about food in Cambridge, there are going to be lots of people going to want to talk about various things, maybe the Market Square, challenge the clone town issue around Cambridge. Mm. There's lots to talk about. New developments happening, which are going to be very exciting around food with the university, with their developments along Mill Lane and the Northwest Cambridge. There's lots happening.
And I think Tim Hayward hosts it extremely well as well. I think he has a knack of getting people to talk, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. And he's very knowledgeable, of course.
Yeah. When will we be able to get full details? When's the brochure available?
Well, the brochure is going to be on the streets from the week beginning the 7th of April, which people can pick up around the usual places, which we will be tweeting about. And also I'll perhaps come on the show and let people know about that nearer the time. But from the 31st of March, the programme will actually be on the website, so people can look at that and can start booking at that point.
Because many of these things will need to be booked in advance.
They will, yes. Although a couple of people have actually been tweeting, some naughty people have been tweeting about their events, we really want everyone to have a fair go at it, and so that all events are released on the same day.
Yeah.
So it's fair to everybody. Because last year, I think most of our events were actually sold out before the brochure really hit the streets. So this year we've got to be really fair to people.
Yes, I remember that from last year. But some of the pop-ups, I think, will be very eagerly sought after. So
well, there's going to be lots of exciting things.
I hope the website doesn't crash on the 31st of March, Glastonbury style.
Fingers crossed. Right.
Okay, thanks very much, Caroline.
Thank you.
God, I'm really looking forward to that. Your little Glastonbury reference there. Last year, it was like a food rock concert in that place.
Not everything is confirmed yet, so Caroline couldn't give full details. We'll get an update from her next time. Cambridge 105, by the way, is media partner for Eat Cambridge, along with Cambridge Edition.
What were the dates again?
Yeah, the brochure will be online on the 31st of March and in shops week beginning of the 7th of April. The festival itself is the 10th to the 24th of May.
Your city, our city, because we live here too.
Cambridge 105.
And this is Flavour here every fortnight with Cambridge's food and drink news. Still to come, Gigi Perry will be presenting ideas for food and drink tasting with family and friends, and Aoife Maxwell will be experimenting with cocktails.
5 weeks ago, the Urban Shed opened in King Street, which already has distinctive eating places and a focus on quality. The Urban Shed is a sandwich bar with a good sense of style and a strong understanding of food, as Alan found out when he spoke with Simon Morris and Billy Ballum, who began by explaining they were both experienced chefs.
Well, we're both chefs. I trained with Raymond Blanc. Billy was my trainee at one of the eateries in Cambridge, and he followed me around and went off and did his own thing. And we met up at the Tickle Arms of Whittlesford, where we gained Michelin entry for them, and we decided that we want to do it together. So we're both high-end chefs, technically, so we take a lot of pride in the food that we prepare.
So the things that we see photographs on Twitter of, they're all made here then? There's nothing bought in?
Well, the bread that we buy in is from Dovecotes, because, to be quite frankly, we're not bakers and we're not as good as Dovecotes, so we're not going to pretend. But the produce that we offer in our sandwiches are all homemade, and we take a lot of pride in what we do. We believe that sandwiches are not just things between bread. Sandwiches need to be given the love like a dish in a restaurant would, and that's what's...
So what makes a good sandwich then?
Well, what makes a good sandwich is quality butter. You know, we use quality butter and the fillings, obviously, and there has to be the right ratio of filling versus bread, and also the filling itself needs to be of good quality.
So could you give us an example of the sort of fillings you'd have?
Well, the best seller by far is a barbecue aubergine, Swiss cheese and cashew nut butter. Another top seller is the Scotch smoked salmon, orange and poppy seed mascarpone with fresh watercress, which is also a popular. And then we do other things like fajita chicken, smoked cheddar and guacamole, which is also a good seller. Billy roasts the chickens here, so it's proper chicken. It's not bagged frozen rubbish. It's proper chicken. The beef sandwiches, we get our own topside rump in. Billy seasons it up and we roast it here. Sausage rolls is by far, a very popular thing that we're offering here. Billy makes his own sausage rolls, from pork and caramelised onion to venison and red currant, which are proving a big hit. We also do our own pies. The pie shells we get from Dovecotes because he makes a good pie shell. But we put the fillings in.
So what sort of fillings on?
Well, we haven't put them on the menu specifically because we have a mess around. We do stuff like baked ham, cider and leek. He did harissa lamb the other day, which was quite popular. It just depends what we fancy making. It's not really a set pie, if you like.
Is pricing a difficult thing to do?
Not necessarily. We decided that we would be good quality value for money priced, and that's something that we wanted as a long-term gain. We didn't want to put it too expensive. We just didn't. We wanted to give value for money because we're both Cambridge locals, if you like, and we know what we want to pay for things. So we've gone for long-term gain, and we've set the prices at an affordable price.
Is it building?
It's building every week as progressive, a little bit more in the till, if you like, and more faces coming back, which is always positive. We've done it the hard way. We've gone for we've done mega advertising.
So there's a lot of word of mouth.
Word of mouth is what I've been for.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people coming back, and as you say, there is people talking about this quite a bit. We hear things ourselves when we're out and about, which is always positive.
And this road has become, King Street is becoming quite a foodie destination, actually, isn't it?
Well, it's been desolate for so long, I think. King Street, Mill Road has got a good footfall and gets a lot of good press, and they do good things up there. But I feel that King Street could benefit from almost, probably a bit over the top, but Portobello Road retro-y kind of look to it, or Shoreditch, if you like, with the afternoon teas opening, Sticky Beaks just around the corner, and us, we all complement one another. If you want good cake and the likes, you go to afternoon teas. Sticky Beaks has got a lovely atmosphere and nice feel to it. Clowns, if you want lasagna, tiramisu, and you want some Italian experience, go next door. If you want sandwiches and retro goods and a bit of banter or whatever, come to us, and I think we all complement each other.
And you've got a garden out the back, have you?
That's right, yeah.
And what's happening there? What are the plans for that?
Well, we're in talks at the minute with a renewable energy company, Cambridge-based, and St Faith's School through the renewable energy. Nothing's confirmed yet, but we've got plans to turn it into a sort of interactive garden, if you like, whether it's be with solar panels or whatever. Everything out the back is recycled. We use all our milk cartons. We keep them for hanging baskets. We plan to do a visual beehive, if we can, if it permits, hollowing out a 1950s television and making it a visual beehive. So things are happening.
So there'll be people sitting out in the sun in King Street.
Well, certainly in the garden anyway. It's not necessarily a mad sunspot, but it'll certainly be interesting to be in.
There is a lot of retro feel about the place. Can you just describe what sort of things you've got here, Simon?
We buy a lot of 1950s, 60s, 70s furniture, Sifono heaters, Robin Day furniture, G-Plan, Ladderax, Aircool. We've got a mixture. We've got a 1970s, 60s cube chair, that's probably the only one in the UK. And everything is retro. We do house clearances and things like that, and pick things up. And we've been up and down the country for the last 2 years between us buying things. And it's got that sort of urban vibe with a mixture of upcycled spool tables and we made the breakfast bars out of old pallets and things like that, so we've done a bit of upcycling and it all blends well.
It looks good. The curtains are quite distinctive.
Yeah, they're made with the coffee bags that we get our coffee beans from. We made them into curtains. They're quite effective.
Yeah.
But on the topic of coffees, we make a flapjack, incidentally, that we get the husk from our coffee bean when it's roasted and we make our flapjacks with that. But yeah, we wanted to create. It was important that we created that somewhere you came in, and in this instance, a sandwich and a coffee, that you felt at home. And that We wanted you to feel like you were in a living room, and that's what we've created.
Well, it very much feels like that. Yeah. People are enjoying it, I take it.
People love it, you know. Yeah. We had a woman, for example, or a lady who was in at the beginning, who had a cafe in the 1970s on Mill Road, who in fact got quite emotional because her cafe, being this is a sandwich bar, was very similar in terms of the decor and some of the items that we've got here she had in her shop, and she was quite emotional about it. Yeah. She was quite nice, but not good at the same time.
Yeah. When's the garden likely to be open, do you think?
There's no sort of set date yet. We're hoping in the next couple of months, really.
So in time for summer, then?
Yeah, by the summer, that's what we're hoping. As soon as we get the hive and stuff and the stuff where we want it.
Yeah. And how many people will it fit?
Not 100% sure. Between sort of 16-ish, because we don't want to make it too cramped. We want it cosy. So.
Yeah, and that's another nice thing about here, isn't it? Indoors, it's not cramped at all.
No, it's a nice space. There's plenty of room. At the same time, you don't feel like you're squashed in just to make, you know, for us to make as much as we can. So.
Yeah.
Dinner parties is something that we're going to be trying to focus on as well. You know, we come to your house and do bespoke menus for you that we've discussed, whether 3, 4, 5 courses. And we come with all the crockery, etc. And, you know, we come cook at your house, do all the dishes, mop the floor, leave you to it. So there's no babysitters, no taxis or anything to worry about. That's something that we want to look at.
That's pretty good from chefs with your experience.
Well, exactly, yeah. You know, we've done dinner parties. I myself have done quite a few dinner parties for the rich and famous in Scotland. And, you know, Billy's done dinner parties for quite a lot of the houses in Cambridge, having worked for a catering company, a local one. So it's something that we wanted to, you know, to explore as well.
Yeah, oh, that's great. It gets better and better.
That was Simon Morris and Billy Ballum from the Urban Shed in King Street. It's on the same side of the road as Clown's Cafe, but slightly further towards Midsummer Common. And it's a great looking place, very comfortable and easy.
Yes, nice. And I thought the idea of Simon and Billy doing all the work for a dinner party was a good one too. But of course you can also enjoy much more informal nights with friends, family and food. I spoke with Gigi Perry, food writer for Varsity, about ideas for this. Gigi, there's quite a few Cambridge University food societies, aren't there? Well, I'm wondering what they're like, what they do, and I'm also wondering whether people could do that sort of thing at home with friends, with family. So could you tell us a little bit about them to start with?
Yeah, sure. We're very lucky that there's a huge, enthusiastic and also very hungry student body. So there are lots of food societies that are set up and drink as well. And what's brilliant about that is that because they're totally student-run, they differ from year to year. So it's always something different. So most recently, there's been the Cambridge University Food Society, which obviously encompasses lots of different types of food. But you have more specifically whiskey society and ale society, chocolate, tea and things. So they also appeal to a more niche market. But also it does give a platform to broaden other people's horizons to things that, and changes the sort of stereotype of, for example, whiskey. So it's a sort of much more contemporary drink. It's lots, and it opens up your eyes to pairings that there can be because of the tastings that are run.
You match flavours.
Yeah, so often the different societies will actually combine. So the whiskey society and the chocolate society did a pairing, looking at different types of flavours that went well. And you sort of were given guidance but allowed to taste it yourself and see what you think.
Yeah, what sort of guidance are you given?
So, for example, there's a Jura whiskey which we were sort of given, this is when it was a cheese tasting, and that was like a smoked Wensleydale, and they said it tasted of there was like a it was a coffee flavour that you got from it, and so you're sort of, you know, that's what you're looking out for. So you don't have to have any expert knowledge at all, but if you do, obviously as well, you can get huge amounts from it. And then so you get things that are much more niche like that. But then also you have recently for the charity Rag Week, which is the university charity, they had a Mad Hatter's Tea Party. And they brought in various different societies for that. Through doing an event like that, you'll come across another society that maybe you wouldn't have naturally been drawn to.
Do you think that it's replicable? Do you think people could do it at home with friends and family?
I really do think it is, because part of the joy and the enjoyment of going to the food society meetups and tours that they run and chats is that you don't have to know anything about food. or the food you're tasting. And it really is a case often of what do you like, what don't you like, the sort of the smell of the food or drink, appearance, and the taste as well. And what's good about a tasting is that you get guidance with that. But if you do it at home, you can just compare different, so you could choose, I would say, sort of 3 to 5 different types of whatever you want, and whether it be differing in quality or origin or sort of where it's come from or brand. And the more you talk about it and just say what you think, that's what's enjoyable about it, and you get to eat it.
Yeah, well, it's sparking off thoughts in my mind as you speak, like chocolates with different amounts of cocoa solids in. That would be quite an interesting thing to do. I can see also an advantage in sort of tipping you off, saying that this wine maybe tastes slightly whatever, or this whiskey tastes slightly smoky, because it brings out the need to have the right vocabulary, doesn't it? And as far as, say, food is concerned, are there any foods which have been... I mean, I think chocolate, now that we've talked about it, is particularly interesting. But are there any other foods which are, you know, particularly rewarding as far as having a sort of, you know, a tasting is concerned?
I think cheese does work extremely well, because in terms of pairing it with other things, you can obviously have different drinks. You can do it with wine, or you can do it with whiskey. But also, you can work through different strengths, and then you've obviously got different textures, and you can really go for something very, very strong or very mild, and it's a very easy one to distinguish different flavours between. And you know, you can get things that have sort of cranberries in or various things, so it's fun to shop for as well.
Yes, there's an awful lot of variety in cheese.
And we're lucky as well in Cambridge with the cheese company.
Yes, which does sell an enormous variety. And, of course, there's the market stall as well,
which sells
a big variety. But when you've tasted something, particularly if it's quite strong, that flavour can affect the taste of whatever you're going to eat next. I mean, you know, cheese would come to mind, I think, with that. So is it necessary to start with the mildest and work up, or do you have a sort of palate refresher?
In terms of palate refreshing, before, for example, tasting chocolate or whatever, you can, if you have a slice of apple or a bit of bread, that takes away any aftertaste or anything else you've had. But then, so with cheese, it is best to go from sort of something weak to a stronger taste.
Yeah.
But I mean, I know with smell that you can, I think your nose can actually only smell, I think, 3 to 5 different scents before you need to refresh it. There is a limited amount, really, that you can start tasting the difference between. Although with the Wine Society, they taste 6 reds and 6 whites in an evening for a tasting.
At places like the Fudge Kitchen, they will allow the Food Society access to actually make fudge.
Yes, they went in to visit, I think it was last term, to make different fudge, and you were able to take a piece away with you. But actually, interesting to note about the Fudge Kitchen is that anyone can go and taste their fudge, and they have a brilliant range, and also sort of dairy-free fudge as well.
When you say anybody can go and taste it, I mean, they'll give you a free sample.
They give you,
you can go in and try several different ones. What, just wander in, or...?
Yeah, I think so, because often they have people standing outside welcoming you in.
Yes, they do, don't they? Yeah.
And actually, that's something about... have you seen the new frozen yoghurt shop on Green Street? Chill. It's really fantastic. And they do 3 different flavours of natural yoghurt, and it changes daily. It's really useful to note that they do tiny sample pots, so you can choose which flavour you want, you know, which you prefer for you. Just the other thing that's I think works really well about the Food Societies is they do a variety of formats. So they'll do different things in the term. It'll be a mixture between something hands-on, so like truffle making. Well, the Chocolate Society did that, but then also, so then you'll go to a talk that they talk about it, or there's a tour. So it's all different ways of getting involved. It's not just always having to discuss food, and it's, you know, you can listen about it or get involved, which I think works really well, because that brings in a different audience as well.
So some of the things that you've talked about, you could do at home with your friends or with your family.
Yeah.
I mean, a truffle making evening sounds really quite good fun.
Really good fun.
And the tastings, very messy. Obviously. And the tastings are obviously...
most important part.
Yes. Right, well, thanks very much, Susie. That's great. Thank you for the opportunities.
And staying on the topic of entertaining friends and family, we hear from Aoife Maxwell, who's been experimenting.
So, Aoife, what have you got for us today?
Well, Alan, it's a bit different today, actually. I was very intrigued by the piece you had on, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, where you were talking to some of the chaps from Infusions for Chefs.
Yeah, right.
About a lot of their molecular gastronomy kit.
Oh, right.
And it was something I'd never really, you know, got involved with or had anything to do with, other than, you know, a passing interest. But I was lucky enough for somebody to send me a molecular mixology kit. Actually, a different website now, Cheeky Monkey Cream Chargers, who do kits like this as well. And I thought we could have a bit of a play with it and see what, you know, different cocktails we could make, you know, different to our usual ones. This kit that I've got actually basically gives you the, you know, the ingredients to try three different techniques.
Right.
It doesn't include the vodka or, you know, any of the key important elements of a cocktail, but it does give you the additives that we need to do some fancy effects.
Right.
And within this kit, then there's enough ingredients to do three different techniques. So we could make a foam to go on top of our cocktail, or we could make little tiny little pearls like caviar filled with cocktail, or we could also make a whole encapsulated cocktail, like almost like an egg yolk that'll burst in the mouth. So today I thought we might try the foam.
Yes.
That sounds like fun.
It does.
The foam is basically made using an emulsifier, soy lecithin, which basically is a collection of phospholipids and various different things extracted from various sources, in this case soybeans, and it helps to hold the air and the liquid together to make the foam. So essentially all we're doing is adding some soy lecithin that's in the kit to our mixture, whipping it up and hopefully forming a foam that can go into
our
cocktail.
Okay, yeah.
So I tried this actually a couple of days ago, and one thing I found was that if the mixture that you're trying to make a foam from isn't very, very strong tasting, the taste of the lecithin does come through a little
bit.
So I'd really recommend having it a really punchy flavour in that foam. A bit off-putting otherwise. I mean, it looks pretty, but you want it to taste
good. The taste is wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So although this kit that I got sent is, you know, to make variations on the classic cosmopolitan cocktail, I actually thought I would use one of my own stronger tasting sour cocktails and use that as the basis for the foam. So all I've got, I've actually already got it made up for once. So in here I've got the last of my blackberry vodka, some fresh lime juice, and some star anise and ginger sugar syrup, which is always a nice flavour. And that's in the classic combinations that I always go on about of 3 to 2 to 1 for alcohol, sour and sweet component. So, and you can see all those, you know, variations on that recipe on my blog. So I've mixed all of those together, and I'll just give you a taste of this now, so you know what it's like before we put the foam on top. Okay, you taste that.
Right.
See what you think. And I'll pop this in the shaker.
It's quite an interesting mixture of things, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great.
It's quite, you know, it's fruity, it's strong tasting, it's got a kick from the lime.
Yeah, that's really
good. You know, it's kind of invigorating. And it's a lovely purpley pink colour.
Love it.
So I've basically mixed all that together and popped it in my cocktail shaker and
really
stick my ice in.
Right. This you must make thousands of ice cubes a week.
Okay, just the usual stir to get it nice and cold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
So we have our cocktail as usual. So let's retire into the kitchen and whip up a foam. So all I have in this container is pretty much the same mixture as went into the cocktail. Bit more lime juice though, because as I said earlier, I want to make sure it's quite strong tasting. And added into that then is the packet of soy lecithin. From what I could work out from the instructions, it was about their one packet to about 350 mils of liquid. And I have that and just use half the packet. So, and I think those packets are 2 grams. So I'd say about, you know, 150 to 200 mils to 1 gram is about right. So in the instructions that came with it, they recommended using a hand blender to try and whip it up and get good mixture. I don't have one of those, the food processor or a hand mixer, but it's a pretty powerful one, so it does a reasonable job. So all we're trying to do is really incorporate some air into the solution, and hopefully then the emulsifier will hold it, so it's going to get a bit noisy.
Right.
So as you might expect, when you're whipping it up like this, you know, you start to get some foaming at the bottom. But unlike, you know, in a normal solution, that doesn't disappear. It stays on the surface. And I'm just holding it at an angle like this just to try and not disturb the foam that's forming.
I don't know if this is a particularly professional technique, but, you know, I'm just learning as I go. It's fun to play.
What if it works?
So you can see after just a short amount of time, we've got a foam that's really staying put and it's not going anywhere.
It's yes.
A very light, pretty pink colour, actually.
Yes.
Yep. And unlike, you know, a foam that we might get by just whipping the liquid, it actually does really hold itself together.
Yes, it is. No sound of it breaking up at all.
No, and some nice bubbles in there. And hopefully it should be able to just pop this on top of the cocktail. Do you have some?
Well, it looks really nice, doesn't it?
It looks really pretty, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
So now we've got quite a very strong purpley pink colour with a light pink foam on top. It's quite girly now, Alan. I hope you don't mind that. Okay, give it a taste and see
right,
what you think.
I will. Thank you.
Make sure to taste the foam as well.
Well, the foam to me tastes fine. I can't taste any
excellent
alien flavours in there. Not that I'm averse to alien flavours, but I think that's great. And to serve that to guests would be a real talking point in itself, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Just something a bit different.
Besides the fact that it just tastes really, really good.
I think as well, the extra texture of the foam is nice as well. I mean, sometimes in a drink like this, there isn't that much opportunity to do something with the texture. Mm. This gives it a little bit of extra something. I think it's definitely one to experiment with and see, you know, what else we could do with it.
And the fact that you said you made some of that foam 2 hours ago and it was still holding. You can do a lot of it in advance, can't you?
I think so. If you're having a party, you know, you probably want to be maybe the first cocktail that you serve.
Yeah.
Or I could kind of envisage it maybe being part of a dessert. So maybe you could do something, you know, even like a poached rhubarb and have a, you know, a cocktail foam across the top to introduce some kind of a little boozy element into your... I mean, it doesn't have to be about cocktails. It could be anything, but it would be
awesome.
Kind of fun. Excellent.
God, that really is lovely. More, more, more.
Wow, Alan, you sound to have enjoyed that.
I did. I it's obvious, wasn't it, really? Yeah. And the good news is that Aoife Maxwell and her molecular mixology kit will be with us again for the next cocktail of the month.
And still, on the subject of drinks, Tom Lewis came into the studio earlier this morning and he talked with Alan about wines from Jura. Now, Jura lies on the border between France and Switzerland. The wines are very different to what most of us are used to. And Alan asked Tom if they are worth seeking out.
I think they're wines for enthusiasts. They are very different, so that they wouldn't be an alternative to, say, something like a fruity Spanish red or a ripe Languedoc white.
And what makes them so different? Is it the grapes or how the wine's made?
Sort of all of the above, really. I think some of the grapes will be familiar. There's Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, but there's also grapes like Savignac, Poulsard and Trousseau, which are not really known outside of the region at all. So I think the easiest way to approach Jura wines is just to think of everything that you know about wine and then turn it on its head.
OK, for example?
For example, the reds are lighter than the whites. So if you're doing a tasting, you'll start with the reds and then you'll move on to the whites. Also, the wines are exposed to air during fermentation. Now, normally you try and reduce air contact as much as possible. And so this means the wines don't have a lot of fruit expression. They're really all about texture and structure. And then the reds are very pale and delicate. So they're almost like dark-coloured rosés, and you'll get some unusual flavours coming through. They can seem quite sweet, even though they're actually completely dry.
Mm, so what sort of flavours can we expect?
Well, from the reds, you'll get red fruits, sometimes something a bit vegetable, and some sweet spice, almost like allspice.
And what about the whites?
The whites are generally citrus, sometimes a bit melon. They'll give you some sort of brown apple flesh and a cidery sharpness, maybe some wet straw as well.
Wet straw, not sure about that.
Well, I did warn you that these are different. I mean, they're definitely not modern fruit-forward wines. The interest for Jura wines, I think, is more about the texture and the structure, the acidity and the savouriness for the reds, a soft, silky feel.
I'd try one out of interest, I think.
Good. Well, I think the thing to bear in mind is that it is an acquired taste. You should probably allow maybe 3 or 4 goes before you make your final decision one way or the other. What you could do is buy a bottle and share it with some friends and then plan on trying one a little bit later and another after that. And certainly my experience of Jura wines is that your first reaction is, oh, this is a bit strange, I don't know whether I like it. And then you sort of go, I sort of get this, but I'm still not really sure. And then it kind of creeps up on you and you find you thinking, yes, I do like this. I don't quite know why, but I do.
So that's presumably why you made the musical connection with prog rock when we did the music analogies last year.
Well, exactly. I don't think anyone's going to fall in love with the sort of 18-minute opuses of Yes's Tales from Topographic Oceans on first hearing. But if you approach it with an open mind and enough patience, you know, eventually you might find you start to like it.
So what wines are there in Jura, reds and whites?
Yes, there are dry reds and whites, as we've mentioned. There's also some Fizz, which is okay. And there are a couple of wines that are really specific to the area and are quite special. There's Van Jorn and Van de Pai. Van Jorn is Jura's answer to sherry. So it's put in a barrel for 6 years, and then a floor, which is a yeast, grows on top of it, and that gives it a nutty tang. And then there's Van de Pai, which is a sweet wine. You take the grapes, you dry them out on straw mats, so you get the same flavour profile as the whites, the cidery sharpness and the nutty aromas, but you get a delicious sweetness with it as well.
Well, this is intriguing. What are your recommendations?
Well, I'm going to start with a red, which, as I said, is traditional for Jura. It's the Domaine de la Tonnelle, Luva Arbasiona, 2011. It's 1695 from Joseph Barnes Wines in Saffron Walden. So, as you might expect, it's quite a light colour. It's a sort of cherry red in colour. It's got an aromatic bouquet. There's some sweet summer red fruits, some spices and some fragrant white pepper. On the palate, it's quite light-bodied. There's fresh acidity and almost barely perceptible tannins. Lots of cherry flavours and there's a sort of spicy finish. So it's quite a young drinking wine. The next one is a white from Noel Young. This one is a bit more expensive. It's $18.95. So this is the Domaine Désiré Petit Lycien Ciel from Arbois Poupien, 2012. So this is a Savignan, which is the grape variety, low-yielding vines, and it's aged in barrique. So it's quite a fresh style. There's some weight and texture, and it's sort of floral with a creamy, nutty finish and some good acidity. Now, I've also got a less expensive white from the Wine Society. This is the Côte du Jura Tradition Domaine Berthe Bondé, 2009. This one is $13.95. Now this is a very full flavoured dry white. It's a blend of Chardonnay and Sauvignon. So this is aged in barrel for 3 years and it's not topped up, so this allows the air inside and it creates conditions for floor to develop. So it has some pungency, it's quite distinctive, but it's got good complexity, and this one you probably drink slightly cool but not chilled. My final wine is one of the special ones I mentioned. It's a Van Jorn from the Wine Society. It's L'Etoile Van Jorn. It's Domaine de Montbourgeau, 2006. It's not cheap. It's £33. But it is aged for 6 years in barrel, and it's really fine. It's exceptionally long, very refined, and that sort of accounts for the price. Mm. And also, it's got the potential to age. It has a drinking window up to 2030. Mm. So you could buy a case and try them one a year for the next 12 or so years. In terms of flavour profile, it's sort of sharp and tangy and nutty, but really complex.
And what about food matches?
Well, the reds are much lighter than the whites, and mostly those are sippers, or you could have them with something like a duck breast or a game tureen if they're weighty enough. The whites probably need some hearty food to go with them, so pork, full-flavoured chicken, maybe a good free-range bird, or something in a creamy sauce.
And if you want to learn more about Jura wines, where would you go?
Well, hopefully it's piqued your interest.
Yes.
The undisputed authority on the region is Wink Lorch, and she's just published the first book in English on Jura. So there's an introduction by Raymond Blanc, and as well as the wines, she also covers regional cheeses, including Comté, the sausages, other local foods and drinks, and she's got tips on where to stay, eat, shop and visit. The final details on Wink's book are that it's a paperback, it's 350 pages, and she's got 200 photographs, plus some maps and diagrams.
Well, it sounds very good, very comprehensive. How do we get a copy?
Well, it's called The Jura Wine Book, simply enough, and it's available on Wink's website, which is winetravelmedia.com, and it's priced at £25.
Brilliant. OK, thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks to Tom for that, and he'll be back next time with recommendations for wines to go with our Tapper of the Month. And now, time for some food and drink news.
There are a few tickets left for tonight's Cambridge Food and Wine Society event. It's an evening of South African food with local wines. It's £23 for non-members, and you can apply via the Facebook page.
On our last programme, we featured an interview with Evie Edwards of Cambridge Food Bank, She said that the biggest expenditure the food bank has is paying rent to the council for its warehouse and office accommodation. We were rather surprised by that, and so we looked into it, and we've learned that Cambridge Food Bank has to pay around £23,000 per year to the council and receives no grant at all from them, or indeed from any other local authority. They do receive the mandatory 80% relief on the rates, but do not receive the discretionary 20% additional rates relief, which the City Council has the power to grant because they apparently don't fit the council's criteria.
If you want to help the food bank, for example through cash donation or by fundraising at work, giving food or by volunteering your time, have a look at their website where you will find all the details. At the moment, they are looking for distribution centre helpers in Chesterton, drivers and warehouse workers.
And now for those of us who can afford to eat, we have some supper club and pop-up news. Urban Street Kings have an event at Sticky Beaks on the 30th of March, and that's 6 courses for £30. There were still a few tickets left yesterday, and you can book via their website. It sounds marvellous, and it's indoors too.
Estefania Led Ramos has an event at Joseph Barnes Wine in Saffron Walden. It's on Friday the 4th of April at 8 p.m, and it's £25. They will be offering a selection of sherries, which will be paired with traditional tapas. Book via Joseph Barnes' website. There's music now. The menu is fantastic, and you can see it on Estefania's blog, Que Rico Tapas. Tickets are selling well, so don't delay.
Franglais Kitchen will have a supper club on the 23rd of May. That's part of Eat Cambridge, so as we heard before, you can book from the end of this month.
How did Urban Street Kings event at Og Magog Hills go? It sounded fun.
Yeah, I wasn't there that night. I was eating somewhere else. But some people said they hadn't realised it was an outdoor event and they got a bit cold. And there were one or two criticisms about organisation too, but the food was highly praised all the same.
Their guerrilla kitchen idea is a good one, but I guess outdoors in March is a bit early for most of us. But a reminder that they are at the Free Press Pub in Prospect Row from Tuesdays till Fridays at lunchtime.
At the Black Cat Cafe in Mill Road, there's a psychic supper on the 17th of April. Check their website for details.
Finally, Inda's Kitchen is developing in interesting ways. They now focus on a different region each week. This week it's been Goa, next week it's Gujarat. And they're also supplying some delis with items like samosas. And they're offering cookery classes in your home for 4 to 8 people, so your dinner guests can cook their own meal. If they're not into that sort of thing, then Inda's Kitchen will do all the cooking at your house for 10 to 20 guests.
Yep, all of which helps us wrap up another edition of Flavour.
Keep in touch with the Cambridge Food and Drink News by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. Previous editions of the programme are available on iTunes and our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website.
Coming up next is Saturday Lunch.
So thanks to all our interviewees today, and until the 5th of April, it's goodbye from Flavour.
Goodbye.